just a good old boy, never meaning no harm.
Good old boys.
I'm Mark.
Bog Beef. Today we're joined by the host from The Blaze. Talk about a steal, by the way, on behalf of The Blaze. Whoever's hiring people, because if you would like, if you look at any account, and this is before you had any, before they hired you or anything, you just, I always tell everybody I knew Oren before he had a Twitter account. You know what I mean? But because when, as soon as you open a Twitter account, it was obvious that you were just you had the hot hand, really good at. Which, speaking of which, real quick, this episode is brought to you by our sponsor, WBSApparel.com. White Boy Summer. Shirts, hats, t-shirts, they have our merch, our get the new patronage patch. You can click on our little link there, WBSApparel.com, White Boy Summer.
No Oren merch yet, though.
Working on it. It's a work in progress.
Oh yeah, we gotta get that Total State t-shirt. Let's go. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, it'd be a good finishing move.
we get an array of signs, you know, that you can have.
Yeah.
You can tap at your leisure.
I mean, I challenge anyone, you know, run the metrics. There's no one that is as good at it, as good at tweeting meteoric rise. And it's not like you didn't get there just by, you know, so you can blow up a lot of different ways. I mean, feel free, just go check out like Bill Kristol Twitter. You'll see like people that are brain dead, that have like a million followers just because, you know, this guy retweets them or that guy retweets them. But, you know, this is one of those things that some things, if you get good at it, it's like, I think everybody's like everyone tells a lie once in a while. But if you're really good at it, you become now all of a sudden you're a charlatan just for being good at something everyone does. Now, if you're someone like me who, or like everyone else that has a Twitter account, you know, you watch the news or something, and something will get up your ass. You'll say, "Oh man, this pisses me off. I'm gonna go pop off right now." And you'll do that, and most of us do. But you're really good at it, and so that puts you consider yourself a propagandist.
I appreciate it, though. It does feel like you're complimenting me on being a very good prostitute, like excellent at. Which, you know, journalism, you know, that's a fair comparison. So I guess I can't really.
It's a dangerous skill, you must admit.
It's true.
Well, the former journalist now in your role is kind of like the reformed OnlyFans thought, you know?
I'm trad wifing it now, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Gonna get a head covering and you know, start taking pictures in fields of flowers.
The thing about Oren is he's a five-tool player, right? Because like, there are some people who are really good at tweeting, some people who are really good at making short videos, some people who are good at making long videos, doing interviews, and writing things. But most people aren't good at all of them together, and you are. That's one of the reasons why you blew up. And it was not, I wouldn't say quickly, because you put in a lot of work and time into it, but there are a lot of people sitting on the sidelines who would have sold their soul to I guess reach a level of output, if that makes sense.
No, I appreciate that, man. It's very kind.
No, I'm serious though. Do you consider yourself a propagandist?
I mean, sure. whenever you're trying to mass communicate, you have to be. There is no other way to do that. And so I try to do my best to pepper things in. I am by training a teacher, and so I know that you have to start things at low resolution and then you can bring things up to high resolution. And it turns out that's also just really good for mass communicating. You bring people in with a very simple version of something that is easy to grasp and catchy, but then once you have their attention, you can scale that up to something that is more valuable. And so at least I try to tell myself that what I'm doing is, you know, making things accessible and interesting and catchy and shareable at that propaganda level, so that once people come in at the top of that funnel, they can eventually reach a place where I'm also explaining them in long form content, more complicated versions of that idea.
That's a great point. And I mean, in terms of like, I'm sure it just came natural to you. I mean, because we, you know, I think there's, you know, people like Dave the Distributist. He's written articles, he's done videos, and he's tweeted. But like, you know, he's so good at making videos. Whenever he does any of the others, people just yell at him to make videos and stuff. But but regardless, you have like these. I don't know if you have Gen Xers that are doing stuff like this, which is basically like you'll fire off the you know, the 5-word tweet, the punchy tweet. You got a 10-minute video, and then you have an essay. Like, does the you know, the whole sort of content, like, you know, the like you said, zoomed out all the way to zoomed in, which is sort of, that's how we all sort of deal with ideas. Even if you're, I mean, there's nothing weird about it at all. It's kind of one of the great things about the internet is that you can, something like, you know, you can see something like, you've seen there's a very low resolution argument on Twitter about like the height of trucks or the size of trucks sold in America, which is, it's good for like insults, but then you can, well, you're there late, your browser on your phone, you can make do a click and now you're sort of seeing an argument, and then boom, now you're reading the you know, the text of the chicken tax law signed by LBJ or whatever. So I don't know, it is cool to see that, like, that I, you know, I people like I think sort of the all-star propagandist, we'll use that word, it's funny, it has a, I don't know what other word to use, but of like the Gen X generation, someone like Ann Coulter or whatever, I don't think any Gen Xers is able to do that. It's just really cool to see that people like the Blaze sort of saw that and picked you up, and I don't know, it's really, really awesome.
I mean, it's certainly nice to be able to earn a living for it now. I don't have to squeeze it in between work and family and everything else like I used to, and that this is a much, much better way to do things. And that gives me time, like I said, to iterate on things. One of the things that people will say a lot is, oh, you repeat yourself often, which is 100% true. But again, the reason I do that is because my two professions before what I'm doing now were teaching and journalism. And what I learned from both of them is that almost no one learns anything or gets anything the first time. And that you have to represent it at, like I said, many different levels. And so one of the things that I get to do now, like you said, playing it across many different formats, from tweets to writing to you know, podcasts and everything, is basically you can reiterate something, you can go over it in different ways and at different levels, you can zoom out and zoom in. And that means however someone needs to consume the content, like wherever they are along their journey on that concept, I'm hoping to provide them something that gets them closer to the next level. And that's one of the beauties of the Blaze, you know, letting me do what I do now, is I can iterate on that, you know, and so I'm not you know, everyone's got to do content grinding when you have a daily show. But instead of being the guy who goes over the 10 stories of the day, the same 10 stories everyone else is doing of the day and giving your slightly different spin, I get to spend that time iterating on an idea and kind of spinning it up from a small sentence to something that's hopefully more useful and complex for people.
You know, Hitchens got accused of repeating himself a lot. And he said, yeah, well, a guy who tells the same joke every night gets really good at telling that joke. Mm-hmm. And I do want to get into talking the total state, but before we go there, I think it is obvious, and we probably even talked about before, that you're definitely dropping, you're definitely a gateway, someone that's sort of sliding a manila envelope under the doorsill of, like, perhaps boomers or something, people who just sort of Fox News people, and then, you know, who maybe they're following Glenn Beck or something, maybe Matt Walsh or something, they see your idea retweeted. And, you know, a lot of these sort of NRX ideas and stuff, they are very punchy the first time. And now that's something we've talked about before. So I know you are definitely, you know, red pilling the boomers out there, but do you think, when you're crafting your letters and tweets and videos and stuff, Do you think that you are also reaching anyone who like would currently consider themselves a Democrat, even a little bit on the left, or the more sympathetic to the left, or the right wingers are crazy? Do you have those people in mind when you are writing?
That's never my target audience, though that does happen. I'm not big on the idea that until people are in a place where they are willing to reevaluate their priors, that like the weight of logical argument usually pushes them into a place that is very oppositional to their values. It happens. Like, there are people who are just so rational and so dedicated to logical arguments that that does break through. But I mean, I've debated and talked with, you know, high level professors and stuff, and they are almost uniformly, even when presented with, you know, truths and arguments that they simply have no refutation for, just completely uninterested in evaluating their priors, unless they've gotten to the point where like those things have somehow shifted on kind of a personal or spiritual or maybe in a material welfare level for them. And so my job, I see, primarily is explaining, you know, the nicest thing anyone has said about the book so far is it's mere Christianity to get boomers to understand political realism. And so that is my primary goal, is to explain to people who are already kind of my tribe, of my value set, of my belief system, that there is a wider world to the ideas of political power, that there are things that have underlined the conservative movement that are fatal to kind of the right's ability to be victorious in this scenario. And most importantly, probably, that there's a bunch of junk ideology that's been tacked on to like the Republican platform that just has makes no sense when you're talking about actual conservatism, actual traditionalism, actual right-wing thought. And so my hope is mainly to shift those people. And along the way, I have often interacted with, you know, left-wingers, even Marxists, and had them, you know, be convinced of certain things or make a journey. But I usually think that the only reason that happens is because they were already disillusioned with where they were, and they heard somebody that could talk to them about things that they were concerned about. But usually I think it has to come with a shift in perspective first.
Yeah, because people have no problem just sticking with whatever fake stuff they believe. They only really look for a new answer to how the world functions if the breakdown in their current belief system is actively harming them.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just saying, if it's calling it, you know, some people, they can be like, you know, you get stabbed on the subway, maybe you need to reevaluate things, or, you know, just call it new psychic pain.
Have you guys read Jonathan Haidt's The Righteous Mind?
No.
It's well worth your time. It's a book that confirms a lot of things, including the work of Vilfredo Pareto. I don't know how familiar Haidt was with Pareto when he wrote that, but in many ways, he's confirming a lot of the sociology that Italian elite theory is based on. But the really interesting thing is at the end of it, you know, Haidt goes through this whole book basically explaining that logical arguments do nothing to move people morally, that morals are something that are axiomatic. They're almost genetic in a particular way. Like they're he describes them as taste buds, and you're wired into a particular type of taste and you can't really go anywhere else. And that everything is a post hoc rationalization to those moral impulses that you have, those instincts that you have at the beginning. And he goes through this whole book, like basically explaining this and how fundamentally like liberalism has to be a lie if this is true, right? Because this is the very core of liberalism. And at the very end of the book, because he's a classical liberal, Haidt's like, but yeah, we could probably figure this out. Like he spends hundreds of pages making the argument that basically his entire political philosophy and worldview is irrelevant in the face of his actual psychological research and understanding.
It's a beautiful way of proving his own point of the book.
It's very true. And so I've just run into this many times. Same thing with Peter Boghossian. I had a discussion with him on Break the Rules And the discussion was about whether liberalism worked. And we spent an hour, and I was going in for a knockdown drag out about, like, you know, battling about whether this was true or not. And Peter spent the entire time, I was shocked, spent the entire time agreeing with me, just conceding every point. Like, yep, you're right. That didn't end up working out. Yep. Nope. That seems to be failing. Yep. No, that no part of that seems to work. But at the very end, his conclusion was still, but we have to figure out how liberalism can work, because there's just no other. And it's at that point you realize, okay, this is just how people are. And all you can layer as many university degrees and, you know, peer reviewed research papers as you want on top of people. But this is who human beings are. And no amount of sophistry changes.
Well, a couple of months back, people were having a debate like, what exactly is an American? And I fired off a tweet that it was kind of a joke, but not really. And I said, like, American is just an Englishman with the tendency towards religious fanaticism and being heavily armed. And I didn't include this, but I probably should have. And most importantly, with enough space around him that you can always move along a little bit further away if you're annoyed.
Exactly right, yeah.
Yeah, but and people like people react, even people on the right reacted negatively towards that, because it's like, well, I mean, that only applies to a little, you know, tiny fraction or whatever. Well, maybe, but that would, if that's true, that explains what happened to liberalism in America.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, that only applies to a very certain and specific and particular.
Yeah. Americans.
Why,
yeah.
Why? Yes, it does. Why? Yes, that would be the implication.
Yeah, the taste bud is a very good analogy for it, because it's not, you know, it's not entirely predetermined, but everybody has tendencies. I mean, if I think about, like, what I've thought politically over the course of my life, I'm right back to where how I was raised. I'm exactly where my parents were when they were my age. You know, you do tend to come home when you get older, because there are aspects that are, if not in your culture, in your blood, people are a certain way. And I guess, I don't know if this is an inherent problem with liberalism, but it's definitely an inherent problem with progressive liberalism, that it just cannot tolerate any kind of distinctions. People can't be different. That's not really possible. They'll say that they love things that are diverse and different, but they don't. They hate it. Everything has to be gray goo.
Yeah, Haidt is such an interesting character, especially from like the NRX perspective. I used to think about him and his journey a lot when I was sort of first. My own brain was sort of using him as like a test case for a lot of these ideas I was reading from people like Yarvin and stuff like that. Because I mean, he's just a perfect example, and especially because, you know, he can't help himself. Like, he is like a super honest guy.
And very well-meaning too.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Super intelligent, honest guy. And he still believes, you know, in liberalism stuff, which, you know, it's hard to think how he couldn't. I'm sure he lives in a nice big house and, you know, I've been his professor, and he's seen sort of the heights of, the things that it can bring. And so, you know, I always thought about, like, you know, I can't remember what it was, but I felt like I read an essay from him that, like, basically explained why, you know, he used to have this project of, like, it might not have been an essay by him, but it was basically this project of, he had some institution that was like
Heterodox Academy, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Where he was like, well, you know, the problem with the sociology department, you know, there's not enough Republicans in there. If there were Republicans, they would, you know, you go back and forth, and at least there'd be someone in there to say, well, that's a stupid idea, blah, blah, blah. But it's like, of course, like, the idea, like, the practice of social science, like literally of sort of tinkering with, you know, the social fabric like that, is just anathema to conservative ideals. It's just the opposite. Why are there no Muslims, you know, in the Bible Academy? Because they don't, like, they're not, like, they don't want to study the Bible. It's like a conservative does not want to tinker with the you know, with the social fabric like that based off a study or whatever. And I don't know, he's just so wonderful. Lately, I mean, he's still going. I don't know if you've seen lately, there's these wonderful clips of him trying to have this sort of reason, ration debate about gender politics. And he's bringing, and he's like, well, I have the study right here. It's from this doctor, blah, blah, blah. And people are looking at him like, he's a Nazi or whatever. And it's so wonderful because he's got, he can't help himself.
There is a beautiful sadness. They're like the walking wounded, you know, like they've mm-hmm. lost and they lost something and they know it. And there's no going back. Like they've seen how the end of their ideology, they know it's dead. Like they know they can see like all of the data and everything that they supposedly trust that tells them the things they believe are simply, this can't continue. And yet, like, there's just no other way for them to be. Like, they rose to prominence under this. They've lived their entire lives dedicated to this. And so they just kind of wander around, grasp, you know, a handful of studies in one hand and the book in the other. And they just, you know, surely someone will have the answer but never does. It's like I said, it's a little sad. It really is.
Well, I think your book can maybe, so your book is called The Total State. When will it be out?
It's going to be on May 7th. But Amazon. You can pre-order it now.
Yep. Amazon. Find bookstores everywhere. I've always wanted to say that. the title just makes me think of this because, if I'm being honest, and I think a lot of people out there are being honest, I don't know about someone like him, but someone like me, and you could see this over things like Gamergate and stuff like that, or the grilling meme. You know, the grilling meme is like the big fantasy now. Like it used to be
an insult.
Right. Now, I mean, like or even things like, all the bread and circuses or something. You can't have bread. Like if you like there's so many like if you're, young white male or whatever, and you can look at the statistics, they're very conservative. And of course they are. Like if they could. Like, if sort of young white males could, like, just go play Warhammer, just play Helldivers, they could just watch the football game and be left alone or whatever and not, you know, not be sort of attacked all the time, everything would be wonderful. I mean, I don't mean everything would be wonderful, but they would accept that. You know what I mean? They would just do that. They would just fall into place. That would be more. It would just be the easier way to go. It'd be the path least resistance. You have people that are like I will fight. I will give, lay down my life for anything like that an American general will tell me to do. Like, and then you have, someone from the social media staff at the army that will fire their ass, for doing that. And so, which, boy, that sure sounds like a total state to me.
Yeah,
I don't know if that's what you were going for with the statement. Maybe you can help us.
Yeah. So like a lot of people, I think, who grew up as a talk radio conservative, I believed in the grill meme. You know, I thought that the Constitution was a ironclad document and we had to be vigilant. You know, we had to make sure that the liberals didn't take our guns and that kind of thing. But in general, the founding fathers had more or less solved the problem of government. We had created a limited government through this, you know, kind of constitutional republic system. And they had, you know, mastered the way that the governments were set up. And really outside of some guys needing to go fight for freedom somewhere, a lot of my friends, I grew up with, you know, a lot of military friends. I grew up on military bases. My dad was in the military when I was young and outside of that and some vigilant politicians, I was going to be able to live a prosperous free life because that's what America was and what it's about. And that's what the Constitution was supposed to do. And, you know, like a lot of people, 2016 rolled around and, things seemed to get a little crazy. And I didn't understand why this guy, Donald Trump, I wasn't very impressed with him. And at first it felt like he was just going to kind of burn out and fade away. But man, everybody got really angry at him on both sides. And it slowly became clear that, a lot of the the media and the Democrats were willing to break a lot of rules to keep this guy from really becoming president and doing what he wanted to do. And throughout the Trump presidency, even though he had a pretty good economy and, you know, an incumbent with a good economy pretty much always wins presidential elections. And you know, the everyone was getting real hostile towards him. But again, I felt pretty confident that things would be fine. And then, you know, the 2020 happens. And you know, I remember talking to people and they're like, well, you think Trump's going to reelected? I'm like, well, yeah, every incumbent with a good economy gets reelected. The only thing that could possibly stop that would be a terrible event, some kind of black swan. You know, there'd have to be this convergence of ridiculous things to kind of keep him from getting elected. And then we had this, you know, pandemic out of nowhere, and everyone got shut in their houses and the churches got shut down. And all of my conservative and libertarian even friends who had gone on and on about how limited government, the Constitution protected us, did nothing. You know, and I kept going up to them and be like, hey guys, like they're shutting down the churches. I'm pretty sure First Amendment says they can't do that. So what's going on? They're like, oh, you know, it's a special circumstance, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, each kind of outrage continued, you know, that they were holding they're holding funerals for Democratic, you know, congressmen, and everybody was allowed to attend just because they were Democrat. And, you know, there were race riots in the streets and they were allowed to do that just because they were friends of the Democratic Party. And they were burning down the churches that the government had shut down. And nobody seemed to really care or stop anything. Even Donald Trump, this super dangerous guy who everybody hated, was just paralyzed and didn't really have the ability to do this. They were talking about forcing everybody to take vaccines and locking everybody in their homes and just all that stuff that I was told about limited government, constitution, none of it seemed to stop anything. And so, you know, that was the moment I got radicalized. You know, I was like, okay, so the government doesn't work. Constitution doesn't work. What's happening? Why am I in this scenario? And so I started reading guys that you guys have had on or familiar with, you know, Curtis Yarvin. And he sent me down the reading list of all these other political thinkers that I'd never heard of before, even though I had majored in political science and focused in political philosophy. And so I started discovering that actually a lot of this had been predicted. And a lot of this, there's a through line of thought of explaining how and why a liberal democracy would transform into what we have now. And so now we're in the scenario where everything, we're supposed to be in a liberal democracy with limitations on the government. And instead, everything is censored, everything is observed, everything is managed, and everyone sits around pretending like we're some of the freest people who have ever existed in humanity. And, you know, that's kind of where I ended up looking at back, thinking, oh, yeah, we've actually arrived. This isn't a warning about the total state. This is an explanation of why we're already there.
So somebody I like, who I think is doing good work, and we talked about him before, Mr. Rufo, just put a thing in the City Journal about the new CEO of NPR, which is, you know, this is the new viral story, because like this lady who's in charge of, it's not our version of the BBC, but it would be our equivalent to the BBC. This is national public radio. This is public broadcasting. Your tax dollars pay for this. If you've seen the news, she just, whatever the current thing opinion is, she just straight states that like a text to voice. Like your Google phone or your Siri or whatever. She just parrots whatever the current thing is, no matter how ridiculous it sounds. And people were making fun of her because that's not really what their conception of a serious person who'd be in charge of NPR. But here's what Rufo said, and I know that Rufo, he says later on that you can tell he understands the problem, but here is an issue with the thinking. She said, they are matriarchs of the American longhouse. That's funny. They value safety over liberty, censorship over debate, and relativism over truth. Now, that's not true. They don't value anything. They have no values. They certainly don't value safety over liberty. Have a discussion with these people about like rising crime rates, and you'll find out they don't value safety at all. They'll make fun of women for being afraid to ride the subway. Censorship over debate. Well, yeah, in some situations, but hey, when it comes to how what kind of medical treatments that you should be able to have or your children. They're all about debate and pushing boundaries. And, you know, relativism over truth, that's true, but that's not a value. Like, that's not a political value. There's no argument to be had here. This is just purely power speaking to people. It's just, I'm giving you an order. And this is so far outside the average normie's concept of what politics is that I think that even using words like they value this is a mistake. Someone like her is kind of a robot. Whatever the deep state, the administrative state, the total state, whatever you want to call it, whatever that says needs to be done, orders have been received, and she's just going to parrot whatever she's got to parrot. She's going to do whatever she's got to do.
Yeah, one of the things that makes you guys so insightful, one of the reasons people come to you, is that you explain things through one lens, as you often say, and it's a really great lens. And it seems like a super simple lens. It seems like everyone should be able to do this, but everyone has been taught not to do this. And so you guys look like savants because you're the only ones willing to do it.
Thanks for leaving the first word out of that. I appreciate it.
and that lens is patronage, right? And the very simple realization, but the very profound realization in our hyper ideological age that you guys bring to the table is that people have interests, that ultimately politics is not about ideology or truth or any of that. Politics is about the interests of specific groups of people. Politics is the negotiation and of, you know, how resources are allocated in an environment where resources are limited. And so what you guys bring to the table is this basic, like, you know, just Occam's razor of, yeah, there's all this ideological explanation as to why this thing doesn't work. But if you just look at where the money goes and where the power goes and where the prestige goes, you can actually just predict what all the ideology is really going to do, right? And so one of the things that I kind of discovered, this is not really what I set out to do, but as I was going through kind of this political, you know, transformation and slowly assembling the stuff that would become the chapters of my book, one of the things I kind of slowly understood is that we have attempted to scale up civilization. We've attempted to grow it from, you know, city states, you know, all the way up to these massive global empires. And in the process, we've had to impose basically the kind of local civilizations of a particular people onto the entire empire. And when you do that, you have to construct artificial things. You can't just, you know, when it's small, when it's, you know, the size of a city or the size of maybe even a state, you know, in the United States sense, then the culture is local and it's organic and it's built into the traditions and the religion and the folkways and the way people talk. And you don't really have to go through and ideologically explain to people why things work or why they're done a certain way, because it's organically part of their day-to-day way of being. But if you want to take that same system and you want to expand it across an entire continent or across an entire globe, you have to start lodging things into kind of this more abstract ideological terms so that you can apply them to people groups that maybe hadn't originally held these ideas. And that works. Like there's a, you know, empires are old, right? This is not something that's unique to the United States or something. Empires can work, but there's a certain cost associated with doing it. And if you don't remember to localize a large amount of your control, if you try to centralize it all, then you have to hyper ideologically, or you have to instantiate it into this very extreme ideology. And so the reason a lot of our conflicts seem irresolvable, the reason that Chris Rufo is talking about truth and this woman is talking about truth, and they all are probably pretty, you know, genuine about their belief in truth, but they can't arrive at any shared answer, is that they're both just arguing about ideological abstractions and their application across a global empire, rather than explaining like what is true and necessary for a particular group, a particular people who need certain things and have certain concerns and live a certain way. And so I think that's why, you know, she can get up there and talk about this the way she talks about it and probably mean every word of it. And Rufo can challenge her on these things and say, oh, well, you're not holding to like these objective standards. And the problem is, you know, objective standards for who? You know, that's something that she is trying to address, right? Because she thinks that it's not, those objective standards are not meeting the needs of certain people groups. She's talking about different people than Rufo is. And that's why they end up talking past each other, even though they probably both mean truth in that sense. And so I think that that's a critical problem. And that's what's created the total state, is the desire to universalize and globalize something that humans can't globalize. You can't actually make a one size fits all universal system of government and a certain set of principles that everyone fits into. And the desire to do that has kind of devastated us both left and right.
That's such a great point, because if we were really, and I know that this is something kind of Bog Beef and I have always talked about, like, you know, outcome versus intent. And Bog Beef, and I think this is correct when you're talking about politics, is outcome is all that matters. But I like thinking about intent. And I say, if you did want to figure out, like, what actual values does this NPR lady hold? Like, what does she believe that would be equivalent to what, like, a normal person before the 21st century would have called, like, a value, a moral value? And that is, like, the interchangeability of people, the blank slate. That is an actual value that they hold. And, like, that one ridiculous belief allows this gulf of, like, when we're having these conversations, they don't make sense, because she'll say, the truth and safety, whatever, and it makes no sense to you or I. But that's because she believes that essentially every person is just like the basic clay model. And, you know, things in the environment happen, it changes people, but really all human beings are just the same. And, like, that's just ridiculous. And if like the building block of your concept of humanity starts there, you're going to get everything terribly wrong. Like, I'll use the redneck example. If you're shooting a gun and you're 3 feet away and your sights are a little bit off, you're going to be a little bit off. If you're 300 yards away, you're not going to hit the broadside of a barn door, because that tiny little discrepancy over time becomes something huge. If you care about what their actual values are and the source of these problems, it's probably that. People are not absolutely interchangeable.
Yeah, it actually gets even worse than that, because you're exactly right. But I don't know if you saw, like, the latest, because Rufo's like doing he's got every hour he tweets out something even more ridiculous that she said. Like, it's a beautiful piece of art. But the latest thing that came out that she said was that basically the when she was working for Wikipedia, they tried to be open and free, but openness and freedom didn't create equality. And because of that, they had to change their model, because the goal was equality, not openness and freedom were supposed to be a road to equality. And so when it became clear that openness and freedom didn't create equality, they needed to do something else. And to be totally fair to her, this is exactly the postmodern critique. Like people throw around postmodernism, it's the scary boogeyman. But this is the postmodern critique of the liberal promise. The liberal promise was that openness and freedom would create equality. And when it became clear that liberalism could not deliver on its promises of openness and freedom, because it turns out people are not, as you say, interchangeable widgets. And if you just open things up and you, like, free everyone from traditions, they don't get more equal. Traditions are the only thing making them even slightly equal. Actually, the gaps get much wider. They don't get closer together. And so what happened is the postmoderns looked at the liberal promise and said, we tried it your way and we didn't get the desired outcome. So the problem is not that equality isn't unachievable. We can achieve equality, but we need to get rid of that mechanism you tried. It's the openness and the fairness that's the problem. And so that's why they've developed this Harrison Bergeon, you know, system of holding people down and creating artificial restraints. Because to be fair, they're exactly right. Like, that is how you actually create freedom. That's how you create equality. It's not freedom and opportunity that create equality. It's oppression and repression that create equality. And if that's your actual goal, if equality is the real goal, then the solution has nothing to do with open liberalism.
And then you toss in Civil Rights Act and just not even just the Civil Rights Act, but just the modern economy, like, you know, all this stuff that, you know, who's the guy who wrote the bell curve?
Charles Murray.
Murray. Yeah. You know, it's funny, like all the Murray stuff, like it's implied that like everything there that everyone is, you know, gets angry about and bans this guy and bans that guy. And what did he really mean? All this kind of stuff. This is all based around a game that basically that winning the game is becoming a mechanical engineer, which is, it's a good job. I don't consider it in like the top 10 most glamorous jobs in the world, but it is in fact the only way to it's the only way to like get money through being able to produce the correct answers on a piece of paper. You know what I mean?
Sorry, you lost me there for a second.
You know, like it's all like all this stuff about, you know, all the IQ and all this kind of stuff. It's all based around the idea that like, you know, it all goes back to like everyone playing a game with their kids and with the school system. Like the only way that like the school system and the economic system can actually like fairly reward people as if they were playing a game. Like, okay, these people are the top 10% winners. They won the game. And they get to be in a higher social class. They don't even get to be in the top social class. You cannot get in the top social class through academic achievement. You can become a mechanical engineer, you know, but I don't know. We're getting all off base there. Is this a book going to be for like online people, blah, blah, blah. Or like, could I give this book to my dad?
Yeah, my hope is, of course, that it's widely accessible. Like I said, I think a lot of people who are familiar with the things that you talk about, that we've talked about, are going to benefit from having a lot of what I've said and kind of the way these theories fit together laid out in a book. But my main audience is definitely people who are unfamiliar with these ideas or people who kind of need this laid together. Because, like I said, the interesting thing is I didn't set out to necessarily make this case. I was doing, on my YouTube channel and stuff, I was just doing basically like book reports. You know, I read this from Curtis Yarvin. I read this from Nick Land. I read this from Joseph de Maistre. I read this from Bertrand de Jouvenel. I read this from Carl Schmitt, and here's what they're saying here. But the things that they kept saying, like as I kept going over and over them, started to share common traits. And they started to, I noticed that there was a trend, a particular gradient, you know, for kind of the direction that these things were pushing. And so my hope was that, you know, kind of by explaining this in a very, easy to digest way, people could start to grasp the trend of a lot of what we're talking about here, because I do bring in fairly complex stuff. There are long block quotes of, you know, Schmitt and Pareto and de Jouvenel. So I think there is definitely a lot there for people who are familiar with this stuff and want to grasp a kind of a more complex idea of the way it links together. But I also try to keep things as relatable as possible so that someone who has not ever heard of these ideas or read these authors before can look at this and say, okay, I got locked in my house in 2020. The Constitution says they're not allowed to do that, but everybody's still in power and no one's acting like anything happened. What's going on? And so I hope that people can read that at both levels and kind of get that.
Let me see if I can help bridge what we were talking about earlier to, I want to get you to kind of explain the total state, but we were talking about earlier about, you know, Bobby brought up the Civil Rights Act, which is a very contentious topic on the right. You know, people like James Lindsay believe that you are literally an evil space monster if you besmirch the, you know, the good name of the civil rights movement. I've made this. I've talked about this before, but it's just so perfect. It's hard to get away from. You guys remember the movie Lincoln, right? The biopic with Daniel Day-Lewis as Abraham Lincoln.
It was, you know, with Bill the Butcher, but
Bill the Butcher, bad ending. So in the movie, there's Thaddeus Stevens. If you're a fan of the antebellum and postbellum history of the United States, you'll know this guy. He was, they call him a radical Republican, but like it was a little bit more than that. He was like an insane progressive psychopath politically. Like after the war, he wanted to confiscate Southern land and redistribute it, right? One of the plot points in the movie is that they're trying to push through, I think it's actually it's emancipation laws, but it's very clear, and he's pretty open about this, that he wants a way more radical set of laws, a set of ideas. He wants to push what we would now call progressivism on a country that is not is not remotely progressive, even in the North. So what his strategy is, well, I'm just going to lie and say we just want equality before the law. And that's how my strategy to win this debate in Congress. I'm going to disguise my true motives, which are like how you describe like equality or what we call equity now, kind of a proto version of that. But I'm just going to pretend that we just want equal, we want equality in the process. We want everybody to play by the same rules. But of course, that wasn't the intent, and it never was. I mean, there might have been people who mistakenly believed that, but that was never really the goal. Now, it took them a long time to get there, but I think everybody would agree that we're closer to them. I'm not saying achieving that, because it's not achievable, but closer to them, just their motives and what they say every year merge a little closer together. They're able to just say the quiet part out loud. And the only way for that concept to work, the only way to have what they call equity, is for you to have complete control over everything so that you are the final arbiter of every aspect of a person's life. You can only have equity if, we'll say the government for shorthand, but like if you in power are the final arbiter of everything. That's the only way this works, because you're going to be deciding who gets portioned out the what. Now, for a layman, for a normal person, that doesn't really sound like equity or equality. That, you know, if I want to be super American and put on my tricorn hat and say that sounds a lot like tyranny, actually.
By the way, real quick, just you brought up the quiet part out loud. That comment that we were talking about, the NPR CEO, that reminded me. So, by the way, there's people like the NPR CEO. I mean, we need to treasure those people. I'm not even sure it's a good idea to immediately run the, because like what they are is like, there used to be an amazing, who is the celebrity, the woman that was in Shakespeare in Love? Gwyneth Paltrow used to just be a factory for these sort of comments. Because she had like a, for what I understand, like the way you end up, like there are a lot of ways you can end up in that sort of situation, but she, what I understand, she had a very charmed childhood, right?
Yeah. Her father was a famous actor. Steven Spielberg was like, you know, not her literal uncle, but she called him Uncle Steve, you know, stuff like that.
Right. So she, you know, if you're an average middle-class person, you're just constantly sort of looking around you and hoping you don't get sued to death or whatever.
Right.
She didn't have that gear at all. So she would just say exactly what everybody was thinking all the time. And it just produced all these very amazing things that people would, you know, they'd want to wring her neck or whatever. But like, it's just someone who's like, if you give someone like a ton of access and drop them down like 20 IQ points, it creates just magic. It's just beautiful. She's just fitting out.
She didn't know better enough to lie about it. And yeah, this is what Rufo's really good at, by the way, is pointing a spotlight and, you know, whatever you say, dunking on this person. But what he's really doing is saying, hey, look, look what this ridiculous person says. This is what they all believe. And because she's the CEO of NPR, you can't really just say, well, who cares? This is just some academic. No, this is a person who has an important position. But I guess let me actually phrase what I said in the form of a question to Orrin has something to work with. Like the thing that I just described, having more than dictatorial power over every aspect of a person's life. That seems like that is necessary to do what they want to do. And that is historically speaking, a pretty recent phenomenon. People might have dreamed of having this power, but it wasn't considered remotely achievable, right?
Yeah, that's exactly correct. You know, we talk about, you know, ancient kings or things, and we think of them as these, you know, uniformly tyrannical rulers with absolute power. But compared to the things that the modern state has, it's nothing. They would be incredibly jealous to wield the kind of power that most modern states do. The idea that you could lock every single person in their home, even in the most tyrannical dictatorships of a thousand years ago, would have been insane. And you know, our modern liberal governments did that very, very easily. So the big thing, like you said, is a political formula, right? You need every ruling class, and there's always a ruling class. Every ruling class needs a justification for why they're in power. And as states modernized and became larger and more efficient, they needed more and more ways to justify centralizing that power. And so, you know, if you're going to compete with the guy next to you, and the guy next to you can go ahead and enlist everybody, they can have a draft, they can compel military service for their entire country. Well, you better have the ability to compel military service for your entire country, because if you don't, the people next to you will be like, hey, guess what? We've got a million soldiers and you don't. And they'll just invade you and take over.
You can't beat me. I spend 30,000 lives a month.
I mean, it really is a scenario where, yeah, you know, power is always an arms race. And so the beauty of James Burnham's managerial revolution was that he recognized that while the Soviet Union and the Nazis and FDR all had different rationales, different political formulas that demanded political centralization, the centralization of power, they all ended up with the same kind of state. They all ended up with a managerial state in which expertise was the kind of the ruling thing, that mass production and mass consumption were driving engines of economic power, and that the state, through the legitimization of the will of the people, had the power to compel the average person into doing things on a large scale that, you know, allowed them to stay in competition with the other states that they were involved in. And so, you know, the United States needed a way to do this. The people who were governing the United States needed a way to do this that fit inside their ideology. You couldn't come up with the same reason that the Nazis had, and you couldn't come up with the same reason that the Russians had. You needed something that fit inside kind of the American story. Well, the beauty of the American story is it's changed a couple times, as you've noted with Lincoln, that it changed quite radically. And so one of the continuations of that story is that the government, the United States government, needs control of basically every personal interaction to ensure that no one is ever racist. And this is where the Civil Rights Act comes in. The Civil Rights Act is a fairly simple piece of legislation in theory, but its application required a large number of court rulings and, you know, executive orders and all kinds of other stuff that became this massive web of basically a Politburo. It became everything that the USSR and the Nazis had. It had that level of power to reach into basically every single human interaction. So in the name of equality, the American ruling class has achieved the same level of power that these other ruling classes achieved. In fact, perhaps more in their day-to-day ability, because along with that, technology has scaled. And so the ability of the state to reach into, you know, your bank account, the ability of them to reach into every one of your social interactions through media, their ability to actually make you performatively consent, you know, to go out there and not only just, you know, not say something bad, but I have to actively say something good, lest your friends or your employer or your, you know, college professor realize that maybe you're one of the bad ones because you're not clapping long enough when, you know, Mal enters the room. Like, this is all stuff that allows the total state to constantly have this panopticon on every one of its citizens and allows them to reach in and have a moral justification for the expansion of the power at every opportunity. And like you said, the opportunity is limitless because there's always the danger with equality that one person might, you know, get ahead or might preferentially hire someone or might make a decision that could throw the whole thing out of balance. And so you constantly have to work to achieve. This is the American version of the infinite communist revolution. And not only does it feed the power of our managerial class here, it enables the power of the managerial class globally. There's a reason that they're running trans ads for Starbucks in India. And the reason is that the global American empire's tendrils have reached well beyond its current borders. And they need to homogenize the culture, not just of the United States and its varied peoples, but also the cultures of every other global part of the empire, so that they can also be brought under the managerial control of our current elites.
You nailed it there. If you had told anybody, 15 years ago, whatever, pre-Bruce Jenner, that transsexuals would become like the singular focus of all media and political questions, it would have sounded ridiculous. It's like, why? That's, you mean those people on Cops who are prostituting themselves at truck stops, whatever. It makes no sense. But if you're going abroad looking for monsters to hunt or whatever, this is perfect because you take a group of people who, like, objectively, there's a lot of like problems. Like, it's physically dangerous to be transsexual, and I don't mean that in like the lib sense that like there's people lurking in the shadows who want to hurt you. But it's like you're going to hurt yourself. And like this, it would be like if someone tomorrow said, "We need to make sure that the quality of life for the guy who lives in the camper and uses meth on a daily basis has the same quality of life as everybody else." Well, that would be functionally impossible. Your job would never be over. You would be permanently be on an interventionist foothold with reality, because you have to prop up somebody who just has this aspect of their personality, of their life, that is objectively extremely dangerous to yourself. And like, this is why they're kind of the perfect subject is the right way, the total state, because you'll never run out of work nannying for people who have. I don't want to be mean to these people because I feel bad for them, but it's like you'd never run out of work trying to nanny them, because it's so self-destructive just in essence.
Yeah, I've got a chapter in the book actually called Engineering Subjects for the Total State. And it's exactly about what you're talking about here. That the why has this become so important? And the answer is because this is the most artificial thing possible, right? There is nothing more artificial than scientifically, and surgically altering someone to create the mere image of like actual healthy interaction. Like, everything about this is artificial and has to be sustained by the state, and only has to be sustained by the state, but has to be in every social interaction has to be enforced by the state, because everyone can feel how artificial this is. No one interacts normally with this. It has to be forced down at every opportunity, in every social interaction, every piece of media, everything, every employment opportunity, because everybody naturally pulls away from this. And it's perfect because it gives the government not only someone who is entirely dependent on them for their existence, right? Like, there is no more loyal party member than the person who at every just ounce of their being is completely dependent on this artificial state, this total state. Not only that, but every social interaction they have would be negative, would be devastating, would push back against this wholly unnatural thing, if not for the fact that the state is literally going in and brainwashing everyone and forcing them at the point of a gun to treat them a particular way. And so this is exactly, and that also strips out all of the particularities. To become this artificial man or woman, you have to basically get rid of all your cultural norms. You can't have any traditional religious beliefs. You can't have any just like basic beliefs about, like, you know, there should be male and female bathrooms. Like, all of that has to be stripped out in order to create this. And this, again, just creates that general homogenization. A trans person in India is going to need exactly the same level of intervention as a trans person in the United States does. And so this is the perfect subject for the total state, as you said, because it justifies infinite power for the state in every situation.
It's kind of tangential, but kind of not. This has not hurt anybody worse than mannish looking women, or I guess feminine looking men, because, you know, if you're looking at somebody's profile picture on, you know, social media, which increasingly is a way a lot of people interact. I know everybody's had this thought now, and you would have never had this thought, you know, on Facebook in 2007. It's like, is that a man or is that a woman? Is that a man in a wig or is that a woman with a buzz cut? I don't know. But they have a solution to this. It's that, hey, you have pronouns listed, and you'll put them like on a little form on everything. You can go when your doctor's office. You tell them, you know, what you identify as and everything. And this creates its own little bureaucracy that is self-sustaining. And it would be completely unnecessary if you were operating under, you know, every human norm in existence until, you know, 5 years ago. But that's perfect for them, because now you have taken over another aspect of people's lives, which is always a bonus for them, and you've created more work for your clients. You've now made a new industry.
I was in a gas station before this stuff blew up, but not too much before, like I guess a year or two, whatever. When someone who was gender variant and obviously so went into the gas station. And, like, people started screaming and running out. Now, I understand if you live in Santa Monica, California, you probably see this stuff every day, according to Weezer. But
where I get all of my news.
Yeah.
Exactly. You know, it just makes me think of, you know, the ADL has a guy on staff who all he does. Is he his job day in, day out is to monitor gaming lobbies, the lobby. You know that people never play online games, like you know, a game takes a set amount of time and there's this little matchmaking session, and so like there's like a 30-second pause before the game starts where it's like, okay, we got 18 people here, they have all have a good connection, we'll put them in here and you wait 30 seconds. And it'll be time to go. And normally you can talk during those sessions and people just say, you see that crazy thing on the news or whatever, or like, you guys are going to lose. Anyways, he just monitors those for language that makes people in groups that primarily vote Democrat feel unsafe.
Yeah. So deep lore here. At one point when I needed a second job, I got hired to moderate the forums and Facebook page for a well-known, very woke video game company around the time the whole Gamergate thing started. And I didn't know anything about it. This is actually how I learned about all of this stuff. Like, this is my first step down the rabbit hole, was actually like shutting down discussion threads where people were arguing about transgender characters and people screaming about Gamergate. And I'm like, what is that? And I Googled and this guy Sargon of Akkad popped up.
oh my and, God.
And that's literally how I learned about this entire
thing. You forced gumped your way into all this, didn't you?
I really did. At the ground level. Just you know, someone's like, hey man, you need some extra scratch. I know a way you can get, you know, 15, 20 hours a week just sitting around reading about video games. Yeah, sounds good, buddy. Let's do this.
It wasn't poison, was it?
I'm sorry.
It wasn't poison, was it?
The video game developer? No.
No, the character.
Oh. No. That's a Street Fighter thing, right?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. It's just sort of a funny story of what it's like from the before times. So in the before times, People, if you don't know, that Nintendo used to have sort of very strong, like, moral guidelines. And it's like Castlevania had, like, edited out the crosses and stuff like that.
When they went to Japan, I think, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry, what you mean?
Sorry. Anyway, go ahead.
No, my favorite game of all time, Final Fight. You just walk around this city beating up criminal thugs. It's a great, great storyline. But one of the thugs is a woman, called Poison, and she's supposed to look like just some trash punk street person or whatever. And they did that, and then they sent the game to Nintendo, and Nintendo said, well, this is unacceptable. You can't beat up women in a video game. And so Capcom said, it's not a woman. It's a dude in a wig.
It's funny because it's obviously not in the original game. It is not a man in a wig. It's a lady, but it's just identified. You can't judge. It's all beautiful.
Well, I mean, so of course Nintendo didn't accept their explanation. So they replaced the character. But yeah, I don't know. It's just a weird thing from the before times. And of course, you can see all kinds of stuff that Jon Stewart used to say. Like five years before.
Yeah. He said the T slur on the show repeatedly, because back then that was a funny thing that what was the little midget guy that ran for president who said he saw a UFO. Kucinich. He was the butt of all their jokes. And now, of course, that's what their party, everything that Kucinich believed, their party believes now. And Jon Stewart, has a religious devotion to. So. You know, eventually if you're on the right team, eventually the cranks always win. But you have to, that's an important detail. You have to be on a certain team. So Orin, I'm a long time Orin fan. The thing that you talked, when you were talking about the Total State, that I guess educated me the most was that there's just been this long process. And when I say long, I mean like hundreds of years of just slowly destroying bonds that were personal, familiar, religious, and once destroying it and kind of using that energy to give more power to the state, to institutions or whatever, kind of just permanently encroaching on territory that used to be sacred. That is an integral part of the Total State, correct?
Yeah, I mean, you can actually take this all the way back to like Plato and the Republic, right? Like, how does he build the perfect state? Well, the first thing he needs to do is take the children from the families, right? Get the children out of the parents' houses, separate them, because the state can't craft the perfect humans until it has control of them from the very beginning. And this has always been the barrier to the state's growth throughout history. The state could never actually fill in all the things that families and communities and tribes did for each other. Human existence was highly dependent. You were all under the authority of people. Basic survival required you to be, knit into this network of, church and family and your neighbors and everything, because you had to constantly worry about, food and, raiding barbarians and disease and all these things. And so people were very heavily constrained in kind of what they could do as individuals. And so what happened is a lot of us look at today, and when we always talk about how we were the freest people ever, even though when you look at the size of the state, it's grown astronomically. It has way more power and way more size than it ever did before. And the question is like, well, how could people feel freer than they ever had before while having a larger and more powerful government than they ever had before? I mean, the American revolutionaries were fighting over tiny taxes on tea compared to the confiscation of like 70% of your wealth today. How could we feel freer under our current system than they did back then? And the answer to that question is that the state, slowly in its gaining of capacity of organization, especially after the Industrial Revolution, gained the capacity to take over the duties that once sat at the family and communal levels. And so the, you know, the rearing of children, the education of children, the feeding of the elderly and the poor, these are all things that you used to have to do as part of a family and community. If your uncle or your niece, you know, was getting drunk or getting knocked up, that was your problem. That was your family's problem. These people would die on the street without you. And so you had to step in and step up. And that meant that people spent a lot of their time, you know, they didn't have a lot of free time, not just because they were working, but because they were busy, like being parts of communities, taking care of these people who otherwise wouldn't have made it without them. And what we did is we handed a lot of those duties over to the state. And what that did is it made us feel freer because, well, now I don't have to worry about my aging parents. The state puts them in a home somewhere. I don't have to worry about, you know, figuring out how to educate my children. They go to, you know, school 8 hours a day. That frees me up to work more hours, and my wife can work hours, and, you know, all these things. We can become, you know, these free individuals because all of these, you know, requirements to my church and all these things have been lifted because the state is taking control of those. But what that does is make us more dependent on the state, because that dependence doesn't go away. We are dependent people. We are social animals. We will be dependent on others for our existence, and others will be dependent on us unless we can offload that to the state. But when we offload that dependence, they're gaining power. So we feel personally freer because we got more free time. I can spend more time playing Helldivers or grilling or whatever, because I don't have to take care of all these social obligations that once weighed me down as an individual. So I feel individually like I have more freedom and rights. But as a community, all of those duties have been handed over to the state, and the state has taken the power that's attached to them. And so at some point, the balance goes from people willingly handing these things over to the state forcing them to be handed over because they've consumed all of the duties that people were willing to pass from the family and the church and the community into the state's hands. And they now get to the point where they have to continue to break those bonds. And so that's what we're seeing now is, you know, the state is now finding ways to seize people's children if they don't believe in the state ideology. They're finding ways to do everything they can to take those last bits of sacred authority that people had as parents or otherwise authority figures inside their communities. And we're seeing them try to find ways to transfer those final bits of power over to the state, because those are the last barriers between kind of the state's absolute control of the way people live their lives.
My favorite right-wing commentators, who's like super boomer. I mean, he's not even like remotely like hardcore right-wing at all. Adam Carolla, he talks about this all the time, he doesn't even like his family. I mean, from what I understand, like his mom is like a turbo lib, lived on welfare, like, you know.
Yeah, in the 60s, back when that was, yeah, she was an early adopter.
Yeah.
Chicano studies major, right?
Yeah. And so he doesn't even really like his family. However, I mean, like, regardless of that, he has, like, a retarded brother. And so everybody in the family, like.
You mean literally, like, special needs?
Yeah.
Okay.
And so, like, you know, he'll have him this weekend, and next weekend his sister will have him and stuff like that. And, you know, he talks about, there's this meme that the left keeps doing. And this is one of those ones, like, there's a lot of sort of people that are sort of moderate commentators that I think are ultimately good. Like, generally, anyone that's, like, moderate, like, actually moderate, ends up on the right now, just because the libs are in, like, total dominance. So, like, people like Shoe on Head and stuff. But people like that, they always fall for this one where Democrats will say, like, what we need to do is serve 3 square meals a day at all the public schools. It's for all the kids that start. Right. And because if you don't agree that this is a great idea, then like you don't think starving kids should be able to get food or whatever. And, you know, Adam has done a great job. Like, he's like, no, he's like, first off, like, I pay taxes. So, you know, we have
food stamps.
We have food stamps. He says, but like, F it. I don't care. Like, I'll pay for the meals to be made. But like, this is the absolute worst thing you could buy. Like, the most important thing you could do is make the parents put the food in front of the kid and open it up in front of them. Mm-hmm. And that this is what, and you know, if you say this, people like libs just get very angry. I think part of it is that they kind of know what they've destroyed and what they're destroying. I think libs really know. You know, Janet Yellen wrote this amazing paper a couple of years ago that talked about, you know, Janet Yellen, I assume, is someone who could not be further, I mean, could not be closer to like the, you know, the heart of the machine of believing in what liberalism is doing. And she wrote this amazing paper about how welfare just completely destroyed the black family system. It completely. And like, you could, like, the black marriage rate, I mean, like, it was like higher than, like, you know, before welfare came out, it was like higher than like white people's is now. I read that. I was like, really? I was amazed. And she was like, yeah, well, it was because we had welfare and, you know, the state kicked in. And so, you know, the state will take care of it. So who cares? Yeah. So just kick this guy out of your house.
Yeah, the mom had to hire or had to marry the father because otherwise the kids would die.
Yeah.
And the father had to stick around because otherwise the community would shame him for abandoning these people. And this is how you keep bonds together without the government. Alexis de Tocqueville famously said in Democracy in America that the reason American democracy worked in the first place was because there was a large number of voluntary mutual aid societies. People had a lot of civic vigor, and they went out of their way to join fraternal organizations and churches and other things that provided assistance to people who would have otherwise fallen through the cracks. And you didn't need a large state, you didn't need a large apparatus, because there was a lot of social pressure to be one of these responsible people who involved themselves actively with the welfare of your community. And, you know, I was a public school teacher in Florida for a long time, and we're not known to be a super liberal state, but we saw the same transformation happen with the school lunch program. It starts as just being the poor kids, and eventually evaluating which kids are poor is too shameful for them and too much work for the school. And so eventually they just give lunch to everybody at the school for free. If the total population is poor enough, they just switch everybody, whether your parents are capable of providing the lunch or not, it doesn't matter. They go ahead and just automatically give it to everyone at that school. And once they've done it to the school for the poor schools, well, then evaluating certain schools in certain areas as poor is stigmatizing. And so they just give it to everybody. And now every single student in the entire district is on free lunch. And it gets even worse because, you know, when the pandemic hit, they had to feed, you know, they were worried that all these kids who were poor wouldn't get their food during that. And so what did they do? They issued food stamp cards, SNAP cards, to literally every family. Every single family got the SNAP card. And what does that to do? Well, it trains literally every person with a child in public school to use food stamps. And slowly but surely, people can't imagine a system where the school doesn't absolutely feed your kid at every opportunity. And that, you know, is just this slow but steady way in which the government takes that authority and takes that power while making the people around them just, they atrophy. They have no ability to do basic social tasks that were basic requirements throughout human history for the maintenance of society.
It's funny because you were talking earlier about how, you know, tyrants of the past couldn't dream of the power that every major government has today. And one of the reasons that's true is they couldn't have dreamed of having the wealth is the wrong word, because increasingly it's not real wealth. Just having the means to make large portions of the entire public into wards of the state. And I mean, if we were talking about literal wards of the state, people whose entire existence is underwritten by the federal government, that would be a sizable number. That would be millions of people in the United States. If you wanted to, you know, be a little looser with it, you say people who get a large portion of their life subsidized by it, you could be breaking into 20-25% or more of the total population. And that is a net, I think that's, I'll form this as a question. Do you think that's necessary for its continued, not just growth, but existence, the ability to do that, the ability to play the role of patriarch to every person in the country? You can't really have the total state if you can't do that, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. The only reason we're seeing the scale we're seeing now is because of, again, the miracle of mass production. The boom we're seeing in state power coincides very closely to the ability to cheaply produce goods and to provide material benefits. So, you know, there were, of course, you know, you think back to, feudalism. There are plenty of people who were very dependent on their feudal lords, right? They had to live on this guy's land. They had to kick up a lot of crops to them. A lot of times the feudal lord would have the right to decide whether or not they could marry. You know, they had a lot of power in their lives. However, the feudal lord could only provide safety for a very small amount of people. That's why feudalism existed in the first place, because even with kings couldn't provide safety to wide swaths of the area. You couldn't fight off the Vikings everywhere inside of England. And so you had to farm that duty out to local lords, who therefore received a certain level of authority and autonomy from the central state. And that's what allowed them to wield that power. But it only was ever over a couple hundred people or something at most of the time, because you just simply could not scale that level of protection or anything, outside of that. Now, with the ability of the state to, just scale all of this up so high, they can do this, but it's always poorly, right? So you can provide people a subsistence level. You can get them plenty of calories, but they're going to be empty calories. You can provide people with a bunch of entertainment, but it's going to be crappy entertainment. You can provide people with a certain sense of identity, but it's going to be like really cheap, hollow, disposable, and consumeristic identity. And so the state eventually, has an ability to make everyone a ward of it, but the only way it makes them a ward of it is to make them as artificial and deconstructed and disentangled from traditional bonds as possible. And so people are more and more dependent on the state, but they're less and less happy because everything they're being fed is cheap and mass produced and unorganic. And I don't just mean in the sense of, food, but I mean in every, spiritual, psychological, familial sense. And so the state starts to hit a wall because that, you're talking about, where the people that it's producing, who are all dependent on it, can't upkeep the kind of system necessary to keep that scale going. And when that happens, the ability of the state to continue to provide for people at the scale starts to fall apart. And that's what we're going through now. The total state's already here, but what we're seeing is total states are failing because they can't continue to produce the kind of material necessity that keeps everyone dependent on them. And that's the competency crisis and everything else that we're observing now.
And also, people just don't like being dependent. People are happy to be dependent on family members. Men and women might be happy being dependent on each other. I think probably women are more okay with that than men in general, but maybe not in every culture. But I don't think anybody really likes being dependent on the state, on some abstract entity that they can't see or hear. I mean, I'm not saying they won't happily take the money and run, but they don't really like that. That doesn't give anybody fulfillment. It's funny because I remember I read, Parenti had that book about Julius Caesar, and there were a lot of, Parenti coming from a very left-wing perspective, but he had a lot of good points about, the Roman aristocracy and how he phrases it like Caesar's being assassinated by those people who have their own class considerations, and they kill him because he's screwing up their grift. But where he really misses the mark, he's talking about the dole in the city, the grain dole, which over time was expanded over and over again until at one point you weren't quite getting your complete daily calorie allotment from the state, but it's close. It was something that was probably unprecedented in human history, and Rome swelled up to be this city, a huge city and metropolis. But when the Roman Empire collapsed, you know, you're 50 years later, Rome is a horse town. Nobody's living there anymore. And this is, I mean, this is sad because everybody loves Rome. It's cool. But people look at this the wrong way. They view it like, oh, it was destroyed and all this. No, what happened was the machine that this machine that attracted those people to come there broke down, and there was no more stuff being given away, so there was no more reason to come to Rome. When you would read these Roman authors complaining about the dole and how people from not only Italy but other places would come there, it didn't make sense to me when I was younger. Like, why are they so mad about this? Well, it makes a lot of sense to me now in 2024 in America. I get it. It's not a good situation to be in, and I guess the only silver lining here is that once that machine breaks down, those people are going to leave too, because no one sticks around to clean up after the party.
Yeah, the other thing about that though is, you know, Rome had been falling off in importance for a very long time. Mm-hmm. The emperors had been foreigners increasingly. They were not Roman born. They tended, many emperors didn't even come back to the city during their time. More than once if they had to. The capital, the real capital, the true capital, was shifted many times, including famously, obviously, to Constantinople. And so the dynamism of Rome moved with that, right? That because Rome became a dependent relic rather than the center of what was happening. All of the money to be made, all of the discoveries, all the conquest was pushed to out into the periphery, out into kind of these other areas. And we can kind of see that today, right? Like, increasingly the leadership of the United States treats the United States as kind of just a hollow husk that they have to maintain and farm for tax dollars so they can go make their real money in Ukraine or wherever else that, you know, they need to go ahead and kind of mine the next opportunity. It almost offends them that they have to come back to the United States and, you know, kind of, twirl their cape for the chuds before they go back out wherever they think they're supposed to be. And so the good news is that this means that, like, less and less people are drawn to places like Washington, D.C., who matter. Like, there's still a lot of narcissists and people who just absolute, you know, creatures of the regime that will go there to suck people dry. But increasingly, the best and the brightest are simply not investing their time in government service or being a part of the machine, because there's simply, you know, these guys are all just living off the grain dole in a very real way. And that's good news, because that means that talent, those proto elites, are flowing into other places. Hopefully we're making them more dynamic, more interesting than kind of at the places that would have been the centers of power.
One thing I thought about listening to you talk about the total state, Orwell's book 1984, it's probably the biggest normie reference when they're talking about tyranny and evil government. And it, obviously he got a lot wrong with the methods. I wouldn't say it's pretty common on the dissident right to have the take that, you know, Aldous Huxley was much closer to reality, how the total state functions with Brave New World. But I think what Orwell really nails is how desperately concerned the regime is with about your how you speak with each other, what you think in your mind. Like, the ultimate goal of Big Brother in the story is to get inside your head. I mean, literally to be able to know what you're thinking and control that, which is probably would have made, you figure, he writes this in 1948, people who were alive then, older people, would have just had no conception of this kind of state, of this kind of world. Nothing like this really could have existed before World War I, and certainly didn't. Do you think that's why he has that staying power, that why he gets referenced over and over again? Like, you know, Elon Musk will make 1984 references.
So I actually have a piece on this, and I think there is some echoes of truth in 1984 for sure. I think there is a staying power there.
Everything about Julia. Yeah.
Well, interestingly enough, one of the characters in 1984 is actually based on James Burnham, because Orwell hated Burnham and thought that he would basically kind of be like the guy who would show you like what the fascist state would look like or whatever. But the problem with 1984 is I think it's reinforced by the regime. I think the reason it's actually a containment mechanism. So it's the thing that keeps everybody thinking of the total state in that way, right? What does a total state look like? It looks like jackboots. It looks like the 2 minutes of hate, you know, and all these things do have mirrors in our current totalitarian state, don't get me wrong. But the reason a lot of people, of course, like you said, point to Aldous Huxley is that the regime actually took things in a very different direction. Our soft totalitarianism in the United States looks very different, which is why it's hard for people to fight back against it or even recognize it exists, because the only thing they have is a reference point is a total state in 1984 that doesn't very much look like what we have now, outside of the fact that we like literally change dictionary definitions at a moment's notice through information manipulation in exactly the way that they describe in the book. But actually the best dystopian future novel, the one that really actually predicts things, is neither 1984 or Brave New World. It's actually
That Hideous Strength.
Exactly. It's That Hideous Way, C.S. Lewis, which is actually the novelization of his book. That I will now forget the name of. The Abolition of Man. The Abolition of Man is the essay he wrote as a more philosophical and academic refutation of trends he saw in academia and in wider society. And That Hideous Strength is the novelization of that. And I draw, actually, I quote it quite a bit in my chapter on engineering subjects for the total state, because C.S. Lewis's main concern was that people would be stripped of their ability to interact with human nature and the divine. This is where his famous quote about men without chests is from, right? That they would strip out the organ and demand the function. We still want brave men. We still want dynamic people. We still want courage and these things, but we've stripped out all the things that make us human. And his worry was, like, over time, if you let social engineers alter people slowly but surely, you would strip out every last bit of humanity. And once you got rid of that last bit of humanity, the next generation would be the true blank slate, the one that liberalism actually promised, right? The one that's completely artificial. It only became blank because you managed to rip out everything that made people what they are. And at that point, humanity would simply be putty in the hands of their masters. And so That Hideous Strength kind of takes that. And the beautiful thing about it is it's a very small story. It all takes place in this small college town, but it's about the moral cowardice of the people through the process, how every little moral battle is lost when people won't tell the truth, when people won't stand up for what's right. There's none of these grand, you know, evil, overseers who, manipulate the entire world. Every battle is very, very much about the family. It's very much about between men and women, between parents and child, between, the church and the parishioners. And it's those little battles, it's those small deaths of truth and familial connection and love that actually allow for this kind of rising totalitarianism to step in. And so I think that's the one that's the most beautiful and deep representation of how we ended up where we are. Huxley was more right about the mechanisms, the pleasure mechanisms and these kind of things. But C.S. Lewis captured the spiritual battle in a way that only he can. And I think that's an aspect that's overlooked when we all are political realists here. We all love our Machiavellian politics and our tracing of power charts and everything else. But the thing that's not talked enough about is the spiritual battle that's lost as the total state advances. And that's one that's lost because we forget our duty to each other.
It makes perfect sense because, like, if you know this, who Aldous Huxley was and who Orwell was, they're not really the kind of people who could have made that argument or understood that point. Whereas C.S. Lewis, everybody should read The Abolition of Man. It's really good. He makes all these points. It's kind of sad to read it because you can see that, like, the things that he's talking about, they've come true to an extent. Now, obviously, we haven't really reached year zero, but they desperately want to do that. This is just and I'm going to ask you a crazy speculative question that I've thought about myself. Do you think that's even possible? I don't think that human nature allows it. I think that if they ever actually succeeded in, you know, absolutely breaking down all the bonds of humanity, that like what would come out on the other end would be so useless that it would instantly be destroyed by people who were still recognizably human.
Yeah, so spoiler alert here, but yeah, my conclusion in the book is that no, it's not. I start the book with a quote from the Bible about the Tower of Babel. And the reason I start it that way is that I think ultimately that's what we're building. We're rebuilding the Tower of Babel. We are attempting to scale civilization to make ourselves gods. And the only way we can do that is by reprogramming people to the point where they aren't human anymore. But the good or terrible news, depending on how you want to see it, is that that is beyond the human load-bearing capacity. Society simply cannot exist in this state. Like I said, eventually, as you attempt to reprogram people and reach that year zero, you also get closer and closer to collapsing your society because human capital degrades to the point where it simply cannot maintain complex systems. And the thing is, we don't have to speculate this about this because it's happened so many times. You can actually just look at history and over again, as humans attempt to build these massive, complex systems that allow them to, you know, operate, and they scale their civilizations well beyond, and they forget who they are, and they try to rewrite who they are, inevitably, the quality of the people in charge descends to such a level that the mechanism that was controlling everyone and holding them in place and artificially enforcing year zero upon everybody breaks. And the things that happen after that are never good. But the good news is that means we never actually completely live in the total state. One of my favorite philosophers, Alasdair MacIntyre, predicts this in his book, After Virtue, that managerialism has a hard limit, that it can't produce the miracles that it promised, and that eventually the system falls apart because it can't provide people with the life it promised them. And I think that's true, and I think we're seeing that now. And so that means that there is a expiration date on the total state, even though the fact that we have to go through that means that it won't be very pleasant on the way out.
It's funny. There's a common, the transhumanists and the, you know, the tech people, like Elon Musk is a good example. They have this constant, you know, threat about how, you know, we'll use up all the fossil fuels and this or that are happening. What will happen is we're going to end up on trapped on Earth because we'll use up all these easily available resources that we get energy from now. And we won't be able to go. We won't be able to, you know, travel to the stars and colonize other planets. We'll be stuck here again, farming and burning wood and you know, living out existence. And like that would just be a fate worse than death. And increasingly, I look at that and say, well, based, you know, maybe it wasn't such a bad deal for my ancestors who came here. They weren't terribly, they weren't unhappy with that life. Perhaps it wouldn't be the worst outcome. Now, I know people listening to this, a lot of people will not agree with that because it's a very, I don't know, parochial, whatever mindset. But hey, there's always worse outcomes. And that is if these people tomorrow discovered a way that they could continue this on for a thousand years, that would definitely be worse than returning to subsistence agriculture.
Yeah, the Oswald Spengler calls this the return to the land. And in his civilizational cycle, after the civilization has expanded itself to its farthest reaches and it's abandoned all the spiritual and metaphysical animating things that kind of made it what it is, and it becomes a thing of pure technique and pure abstraction, people get tired, and people simply stop. He actually predicted that Western man would just stop doing science because they would just find that to be exhausting and constraining, and they wouldn't want to live that artificially. And while a lot of people on the right laugh at the left's, you know, the math is racist and science is racist stuff, I think that really is just the beginning of that prediction. I think we are actually just seeing that fulfilled in real time. And kind of the end of that is the return to the land, where people realize that maybe infinitely scaling complex civilization isn't the best way to live. Maybe that doesn't solve our problems. And maybe it's just better to not, you know, constantly submit yourself to that. Now, it's usually not a conscious choice, because actually you just, again, degrade so much that you can't sustain it. And it kind of just comes apart, right? This is why people end up living in the ruins of great Roman buildings, you know, but aren't unable to build them again. But I think it is, you know, people, I guess, can get blackpilled about that. But I think you're right that ultimately, like, are you going to wish for the continuation of a way of being that is obviously poisonous to the people around you forever? Like, is that really the way that you want to live life? Is that really what you want for the children you're not going to have because you're too nihilistic? Like, is that really what humanity is about? I think ultimately the answer is no. And I think the civilizations and the peoples that will make us through this are the ones who kind of realize that before the wheels completely come off.
Gray pill, isn't Spengler's thesis that all these, like, these ideas and ideologies are fake, and it's just the liberalism in the West is sick, and all these new ideas are just cope for explaining why it's a good thing that we're returning to the land, when really it's not a choice. You've burnt out, and you have to return to a less complex form of society, and you just make up a good excuse why. Because we were a colonial empire, it's good that our standard of living is worse, and it's good that we're not having kids.
Yeah, what Toynbee said, great civilizations don't die, they commit suicide, and that's probably not going to be any less true for us than it was for all the civilizations that came before us. You can find whatever rationale you like, but one way or another, you're trying to find a reason why you don't have to keep doing that anymore.
Well, I mean, I'm going to make my best effort to make sure it's less true here than it is in Canada.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which is kind of a, I don't know. It's obvious that you aren't a black pill guy. You're out here doing it. I'm looking forward to this book. I'll have the link in the description. I hope everyone goes out to buy it. You know Oron. You know he's the guy. All these great books of history. You've been reading them and explaining them on your channel for the past couple of years, and I'm looking forward to seeing what you synthesize. It's going to be awesome. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, guys.
Making their way the only way they know how. Let's just